Who picked the hymns for this week? Did you know the connection to Psalm 46?
Well, I've read it before I picked the hymns.
Okay. Well, there is a strong connection to Psalm 46 here with "A mighty fortress is our God." It's actually the title that I gave my sermon. I don't often give too many of my sermons titles, but "A mighty fortress is our God," Psalm 46. Martin Luther, it's a name you've likely heard before. The German friar's 95 Theses is widely considered to be the document that divided the realm of Christendom into what we know today as Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. This is the time of Zwingli, Calvin, Knox. It's an era that would rebirth much of the theology to which we still cling. And so you hear all of that, and even you read about it, and it's easy to romanticize such a time. You know, oh, that sounds so great, so fun, even. But even a little reading will reveal that it was a very difficult time, not the least of which for Luther himself. Luther spent much of his life struggling with bouts of depression. He writes, "I spent more than a week in death and hell. My entire body was in pain, and I still tremble. Completely abandoned by Christ, I labored under the vacillations and storms of desperation and blasphemy against God." He is a little bit dramatic sometimes. But you get the idea here. He struggled, and he was depressed, and he was really distressed that he had actually not yet been martyred, as had been the case of many of his followers. He writes this note in consolation, "I was not worthy to shed my blood for Christ, as many of my fellow confessors of the gospel have done. Yet this honor was denied to the beloved disciple, John the Evangelist, who wrote a much worse book against the papacy than I ever did." In 1527, 10 years after posting his thesis, this was considered to be the worst year for Luther. Not only did he spend several months in this struggle of illness and depression, but also the plague had reached his hometown of Wittenberg, and many friends fell ill and died. Yet it was that year, 1527, that Luther composed what we know today as "A Mighty Fortress is Our God," and he based the hymn on Psalm 46. For in it he found great comfort, despite the trials that life had to offer. Great comfort, and he found no fear. And I hope this is what we'll see today as we look at this 46th Psalm. Now, in Psalm 46, the main idea, I think, is relatively clear. You see it immediately in verse 1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And you see it echoed twice throughout the psalm, verse 7, verse 11. It's a psalm, right? So these are refrains. Verse 7 and 11 refrain the point. And then the three stanzas kind of support this point. God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. As it is with the psalms, and when we consider any portion of Scripture, we want to see the context. With the Psalms, it's very difficult to trace this to any specific historical, biblical event. Specific for Israel, we're not sure. Few really bother trying to sort of place the Psalms. Some do. Some think that Psalm 46 was written after the defeat of Sennacherib's army of 185,000 in a single night. And others consider it to be prophetic, telling of a yet future event. I don't know. I'm fine with either of those being true. Doesn't really mean that's the point. The point is not so much the when here, but the what. What is going on? So I've actually approached the whole psalm as a sort of a hypothetical situation where the psalmist uses his scenarios to illustrate that main point. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in a time of trouble. So, verse 1 then, in Psalm 46, is our thesis. really. It is the main point that is expounded upon in each of the stanzas, reiterated in the two refrains. It's this confessional statement, the nature, the emphasis being upon the significance of our God. That God who is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. God's presence is a significant theme in this song. The idea of him being very present, not just present, but very present in times of trouble, highlights his concern, his love for his people. He's not just available. He's not just on call when trouble rears its head. It's not, you know, they have this sort of weapon sitting in the back that they can just sort of call on if something rears up. No, he's already there. He is assertive. He is proactive in maintaining his closeness at all times, but then especially in difficult times. He's not just available. He is very present with them. You see, he's a refuge and strength. Now, refuge is a place or state of safety from danger or trouble. Strength is obvious. It's that force that we have to do anything. The psalmist is making clear that Yahweh is not just a friend to him. Yahweh is not just a weapon in his arsenal. He is the sustaining force in the life of his people. He is their refuge, their strength all of the time. He is their life force. Trouble does not scare him away, such as might be the case with other allies. If you have an ally, that ally is your ally until there's a better ally, right? And then you might lose them. And these human allies don't work so well. But God is not like any other ally. He has set his love upon his people, and he is not scared away by any force that would oppose them. And in those times of opposition, he is very present. He has no thought of abandonment. It's far from his mind. In trouble, he just draws closer to his people. So this is that doctrine, that theme that you see expounded upon. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. And then in verse 2, when you start to see the people's response to the doctrine. All right? This is how we are to do our theology. We see the truth, and then we see how this truth affects our lives. So the truth is, God is our refuge and strength, the very present help in times of trouble. Therefore, verse 2, we will not fear. They will not fear. The people's response is emblematic of their belief in this doctrine. Because they believe A, God is their refuge and strength, they will do B, not fear. Therefore, the opposite is true. If you fear, then you must not believe this truth. If you have fear, then you must not believe that God is your refuge and strength, or God is not your refuge and strength. Fear might reveal doubt in God. But for these people, this is true of them. They believe and God is their refuge and strength. Therefore, they will not fear. And the remainder of the verse and stanza present a series of situations where God would be their refuge and strength and where fear would be needless. Here are the situations. Very reasonable situations. One, the earth gives way. Mountains moved into the heart of the sea. The waters roar and foam, and the mountains tremble. Obviously, these are extreme scenarios. And you see this in this dual focus on the mountains. You see the mountains mentioned twice here. They're moved into the heart of the sea, and they're trembling. This dual focus is really forcing the point that everything is falling apart. Because in the ancient world, the mountains are considered to be these immovable pillars. They are permanent structures of nature. When they move, their collapse must be seen as extending to the entire earth. What's pictured here is the apocalyptic decimation of the planet. Everything's kind of folding in on itself. And as far as disasters go, you can't imagine something worse. Now, I think the psalmist meant this quite literally. That God is our fear and refuge. Either God is our refuge and strength. We will not fear. Up until this point, we need not even fear then. The most extremist of situations. There's no reason to see this as anything but literal. It's not a political shaking. It's not an economic shaking. Not that the same truth wouldn't apply, but I think it misses the point of the text. There's no reason to think of this necessarily as an eschatological event, necessarily. As in this being on the day of judgment of the nations. That is true as well. And the point here is that even should everything you know around you collapse, fall apart, fold in on itself, your faith in God as your refuge and strength will sustain you. God is your refuge and strength in the most awful of circumstances, no qualifications needed. And that's rare. Almost every statement we make today needs a few qualifications, but God is your refuge and strength, full stop. That's pretty amazing. If your faith is firm in this most extreme of circumstances, the whole earth falling in, then surely your faith is firm and God is your refuge and strength in all of the lesser circumstances as well. Right? If your faith is firm when the earth is folding in on itself, then your faith should be firm if you lose your job. Your faith should be firm if you have economic difficulties. Your faith should be firm if you lose a loved one. God is your refuge and strength through all of the difficulties of life, relationship, finances, loss, and so on. The challenge of the psalm, of course, is not to have one's faith grounded in the finite, in the things you see around you, but in eternity. The psalmist is really saying, how small is the faith that can be dislodged by earthquakes and storms? If those are the greatest powers that you can conceive of, then you truly have not yet met Yahweh. The sovereign God who spoke all into existence can subdue it with the same ease. Why do you fear? Has creation escaped his control? Is the earth acting apart from his plan? Fear reveals not only that faith is small, but also that theology is shallow. And really the two, small faith and shallow theology, go hand in hand, so we should expect no different. But really, fear is a logical response to a potentially harmful situation. We sometimes think fear is this uncontrollable emotion that we have, but it's not. It's very logical. It's very reasonable. You see a potentially harmful situation, and your body reacts in response to that in a way that protects you because you perceive a danger and you perceive that you are not adequately equipped to meet it. If a man or an individual is approaching you menacingly with a knife, you might, maybe even should, experience fear. You perceive there to be a real and present danger in the situation. This is very logical. Walking through a dark alley at night, a man is approaching you with a knife. Makes sense. But what if that same man is approaching you with a knife and you are sitting in a tank? Do you have fear in this circumstance? No. There's no fear in that situation. You have refuge. You have strength. To be fearful in such a situation shows either irrationality or a lack of confidence in your refuge. That's what's happening here. The scenario of the earth caving in would be terrifying if you had no refuge, if you had no strength, no present help in trouble. Many even lesser scenarios would be terrifying. However, you do have a refuge. And since you do, then the presence of these disasters are practically irrelevant to your disposition. Fear reveals irrationality or a lack of confidence in your refuge, in your God. Now, the chaos of stanza one, particularly the waters that roar and foam, is silenced now with the serene river of verse 4. You see that there? The tone changes really quickly. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. A river is a source of water. It's a life-giving thing. The psalmist is presenting the exact opposite of the calamity of verses 2 and 3. It's a peaceful place where life is abundant, even easy. This is significant for the Israelites. They had known a long existence without an easy life, without an abundance of this life-giving source. The presence of the river for the Israelites shows not only present help, but a stability that cannot be thwarted. These rivers just flow. Just the water keeps coming, life keeps coming. It's their stability that's there. And this stability, for the psalmist, he says, it's in the city of God. There's great security here. The city, however, doesn't find its significance in and of itself. The city is magnificent. It's not unable to be moved because it's built so well, but it's this way because of her chief inhabitant, the holy habitation of the Most High. The place is peaceful, it's stable, it's solid because God is there. Within the walls of the city, there is peace and serenity. But throughout the rest of the world, the psalmist says, the nations rage and kingdoms totter. You see that in verse 6. Before, you saw this from sort of a personal perspective. Although the world is folding in on itself right around you, you will not fear. But now you see the perspective of God's people. They were within his presence, yet all around them, the world is sort of falling apart. There's chaos on an international level. The kingdoms are tottering and falling. The nations rage. They have this uncontrollable, violent anger against each other. Everything's moving in an unstable way. All the peace in the city now is magnified by the instability that the rest of the world experiences. There's no surety outside of this city. There's no stability outside of these walls, outside of God's presence, outside of God's protection. There's nothing there but chaos. The nations of the world fight and they move in ways that seem powerful. They think they have control. We see the response here. With a word, he utters his voice, and the earth melts. Where is the control? Where is the power of these nations? This is similar to the total destruction that we see in the previous stanza. The psalmist is showing us once again, safety with God, his power over everything, his control is absolute. With a word, he melts the earth. There is no situation that can be presented to those under God's protection where fear is going to be a logical response for you. Because no power can legitimately threaten his rule, his plans. And this brings us now down to the refrain in verse 7. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Nations, kingdoms, empires, no matter what their military, political, or economic prowess, they can pose no threat to those dwelling with the Lord. In fact, all those without the city are in a place of instability and danger because they have no refuge. Do you see that? There's really nothing. Even though there's powers out there, they're fighting with each other, there's no refuge. Everything is chaos. There's nothing sure. Everything is sort of without an absolute. The only thing that's sure is that they're unstable. They should fear. The things that they trust the most are really just dwarfed now by the omnipotence of Yahweh. They are in a place of deficiency because they are without the Lord. And that makes sense for everyone outside the city. But it's nonsensical for someone within the city to be intimidated by the same things that the rest of the world finds imposing. It doesn't make any sense for someone in the presence of the Lord to be scared now of these nations raging, of these kingdoms tottering, and of all of this mass instability and chaos of the earth falling apart. It doesn't make any sense. They are with the Lord. They are resting in this realm of peace and protection within the city. They don't need to be afraid of the things that threaten the chaotic world. It's nonsense, really. And it's nonsense for those who enjoy grace, mercy, and the hope of salvation from Yahweh to be fretted by the same instability that the rest of the world suffers. Now, I've already illustrated fear, but the psalmist repeats it, so I'm going to do it again. And I think that repetition can sometimes be a good thing, and we'll try to get this from a different perspective. The psalmist is trying to alleviate fear. Now, you've heard of phobias. You've heard of phobias. There's all kinds of phobias. They're irrational fears. Fears that are not founded upon logic, but a perception that perceives danger in places where it's not, or at least not proportional to the actual threat posed. Right? Many of these fears are mostly harmless. But don't get me wrong, they're not without their effects. You hear of a fear of spiders. It's mostly harmless. Some often is good for a joke, but it really doesn't affect too much. It might. It can increase to a degree where it might. Perhaps you've heard also of agoraphobia, a fear of open spaces. You know, that might seem harmless to the most, for the most part, but really, it's going to affect things. It can be paralyzing now when you're confronted with this thing that you perceive to be dangerous, but which actually is not. You have agoraphobia, this fear of open spaces. You have difficulty leaving your home, perhaps, for basic things of life. Shopping or getting groceries. You are going to be consumed by this illogical conception that there is some sort of danger to you in open spaces. Perhaps if you have a fear of spiders, you will perhaps go into some room, and now it affects. You know, you can't get whatever is in that room. You can't be where you need to be. You can't perhaps do what you need to do. You can be consumed with this illogical conception. It begins to interfere with things that are actually important. Your whole life could be controlled by an imaginary idea that danger is standing in your way when in fact it is not. Our fear of the threats of this world, it's a phobia. It's an irrational, illogical fear. We actually construct or adopt a notion that nature and nations are the greatest concerns that we can have. On the surface, maybe that sounds harmless, but it will quickly begin to interfere with things that are actually important. It's illogical, it's unfounded, and it will ultimately be the hurdle that prevents us from living in obedience. Our irrational fears of this world are not insignificant. It's not harmless to live like the world Monday to Saturday. It's not insignificant to be controlled by the same fears in the worldview that the secular espouses. To live like the world in any sphere will have disastrous effects, because it will be like a phobia. Living like the world, for we, the redeemed, it's irrational. What we are actually saying is that we fear those things more than we fear Yahweh. Because fear is really what controls us and how we determine priorities. We always submit to what we consider to be the greatest force. We do that. We cannot help it. We will submit to what we consider to be the greatest force. If we're going to be controlled by the things of the world, we're saying we're afraid of those things the most. And it's a phobia that will get in the way. It will hinder you from living in the rest, peace, grace, and obedience that we should actually enjoy. God's people are to be controlled by a reverent fear of Him. Anything else is a ridiculous phobia that we should put to rest. In the third stanza, the final one here, we see worship for the powerful God of refuge. The final stanza, the forces that potentially elicit fear in the hearts of men are not just found to be needless worries for God's people, but they actually end up exalting God Himself. They think they're powers unto themselves, but they're actually just shown to be servants under God's control. They're not just powers and they're in this fight against God. God's not just the greater power. These are vassals under His command. He is the only power. And this situation is clear that it's not just the outcome that God has ordained, but the entire process. The circumstances that we might wrongly fear are actually part of God's plan to bring glory to Himself. Our worry is needless. In the plan of God, there are no rogue molecules. All of the chaos of the previous stanzas receives the final silencing hand of God. You see that? He just places His hand upon it and it stops. All of the things that people feared most are just eclipsed by this ultimate power of God. And it should jolt everything into proper perspective. You see it here? Come behold the works of the Lord, how He has brought desolations on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. He just stops it. And it's here, in this context, that we receive the second command from the psalmist. The first was implicitly, do not fear anything but God. The second is akin to it, and it's stated explicitly here with a dual perspective. It says, be still, literally cease striving, and know that I am God. Cease striving, and know that He is God. Yahweh is God. Your efforts to build your own security are foolish if you are within the refuge of God. It is like you being in that tank and you spending all of your time trying to figure out how you are going to protect yourself by some other means. You act as if you have lost all perspective. Be still and know that He is God. Rest in the security of Yahweh, of your Savior. Cease striving. Cease trying to build your stability on some other foundation. You already have it in God. Now, this is Psalm 46, and as I've mentioned, it was written probably to Israel. It was written a time before what we know today as the church. So, I think it's fair to ask, does this apply to us? In what way does it apply to us? The tone of the psalmist is explicitly towards those dwelling in a city. And so is this applicable only to those who are dwelling in Jerusalem? No, certainly not. Because you don't need to dig too far into history to see that Jerusalem was not always enjoying good safety. Right? I think you can even dig into a few newspapers to find that out today. Because of disobedience, they were removed from the city even. There's no surety found within the walls of man. What the prophet teaches here is God's disposition towards his people everywhere for all of time. Those who have turned from their offenses and submitted to his lordship. The passage is denouncing the foolishness of trusting in only what the senses perceive. God has not erected any sort of edifice or hedge of physical protection around his people. He's promised that we will suffer. And you see that, John 15:20. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they have persecuted me, they will persecute you. And you see it in 2 Timothy, you see it in 1 Peter 4, you see it all through the New Testament. He's promised us that we will suffer. So what's our protection and our refuge? Well, it's one that transcends what the senses perceive. A peace available only from God through Christ. A security, an assurance, a hope that no power of this world can touch. In fact, it might be argued that this is even more relevant for us than it was for the Old Testament believers. And this new dimension of the indwelling of the Spirit. Do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells within you? So the psalmist is explaining after what manner God is going to act towards those who are his people. It's definitely applicable to us, to the church. But do we act like this is true? Is God actually that refuge for you? Do you actually cease striving? Do the difficulties of this world melt away? Because he is God. Luther really thought it applied to him. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, our helper he amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing. For still our ancient foe doth seek to work us woe, his craft and power are great and armed with cruel hate. On earth is not his equal. Did we in our own strength confide, our striving would be losing. Were not the right man on our side, the man of God's own choosing. Dost ask who that may be? Christ Jesus, it is he. Lord Sabaoth, his name, from age to age the same. And he must win the battle. And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear. For God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him. That word above all earthly powers, no thanks to them abideth. The spirit and the gift are ours through him who with us sideth. Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever. Is this the truth that we actually live? Does that peace of God rule our hearts, rule our minds? Or do our fears reveal our lack of faith in the promises of God? Do our concerns demonstrate our inordinate focus upon the harm that can be done to the body rather than the soul? Think of the things that we fear. I'm sure a few things come to mind. Socially awkward situations. Situations where you affirm Christ while everyone else disparages his name. We fear being alienated by our peers because of telling of our salvation. We needlessly fear man. We hypocritically might demonstrate that God is not actually Lord of our lives, but only our Sundays. We fear economic difficulties. Maybe we worry so much about money that we willfully violate the ethics of our Christian worldview so that we might retain our job. Bend the rules here and there, a little lie every now and then. We have been promised suffering. Its very benefit to our growth has been expounded in God's word. Yet with compromise, we preach that the refuge of God is insufficient for us. And we would rather seek security in the instability of the temporal. When difficulties and threats are upon us, don't we just think right away, we are face to face with this thing. It's me and that thing. We're going to duke it out and we'll see who wins. Are we not prone to believe that anything that comes upon us, we face it alone with just the raw material and resources that we have? Are we acting like the world? Aren't we violating the very principle of the psalm before us? When we compromise, we attempt to remove ourselves from God's refuge and instead cling to the false security of this world, the world that He can melt with a single word. The psalm reminds us of the comfort that we can have in obedience. We can confidently obey His word, knowing that should men despise us, wealth leave us, nations rain their power upon us, or the earth disappear beneath our feet, our refuge is unaffected. And if you have repented of your sins and turned in faith to the one true God, then you have a refuge that will not fail. When the threats of the world bear down upon you, you can restore some perspective and say, "Be still, for He is God. And He will be exalted over all the powers of nature and nations." And you just got to be ruled by your theology. Be ruled by your God. You've not been saved by a God. You've been saved by the God. You are His, and there are no forces that have power over Him. And if you are actually His, then your fears are either an irrational response to practically irrelevant situations or blatant hypocrisy as you sadly display who or what you actually believe to be in control. What we have affirmed with our lips, let us confirm with our lives. Brothers and sisters, be still. Cease striving. Know that He is God. He is our refuge, our strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Even in death itself, there is victory for the one resting in the refuge of God.